Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, a weekly dose of great science interviews and music. I'm Jorge Salazar. Here's a scientist soundbite.
Well, smart grid is an attempt to make the grid more intelligent. Say, a piece of equipment falls on the ground and people are out of power. Currently, in most of the world, the power company doesn't really know that that has occurred until somebody calls. Well, a smart grid will locate where that transformer is through a degree of communication and sensors to be able to send crews to the right location with the right equipment.
You're listening to Bill Meehan, Director of Utility Solutions with ESRI, a company that creates Geographic Information Systems, or GIS, software. This software links information to locations all over the world, and it's being used to modernize the electric grid into a smart grid. Mr. Meehan, welcome to Earth Sky 22.
Well, thank you.
You said that Geographic Informational Systems, or GIS, will play a fundamental role in rebuilding America's infrastructure through what's called the smart grid. Please explain for us this connection.
Well, sure. GIS really is about locating virtually anything that is on the ground. So, for example, the common things like poles and wires and, you know, transformers and the things that connect together to form the grid are located all over the place. And so what GIS does is captures the locations of all of that infrastructure. So if we were even talking about other kinds of infrastructure like telephone systems or water systems, a GIS can capture the location of each of those facilities. And capturing it is one thing, but actually being able to show it in the form of a digital map is really the power of GIS. So if you think about the grid itself, the grid, of course, is the generation, the transmission, and the distribution of electricity throughout the country and throughout the world. It's very, very important for utility companies to know where all of this equipment is located. But not only that, it's also important to know the relationship of the equipment to, say, the surrounding areas. So if a transformer, for example, falls on the ground, you're going to want to know, so what's near the transformer that falls on the ground. Now, with smart grid, so what does that got to do with smart grid? Well, smart grid is an attempt to make the grid more intelligent. So in my example where, say, a piece of equipment falls on the ground and people are out of power, currently in most of the world, the power company doesn't really know that that has occurred until somebody calls. So, if your power is out, the first thing you do is grab your phone and call somebody and say, hey, my power is out. Well, a smart grid, amongst many other things, will locate where that transformer is through a degree of communication and sensors to be able to send crews to the right location with the right equipment. So they'll know what to do in case of emergency. So it's kind of the connection of the grid becoming much more intelligent and also having the technology in place to be able to empower sort of that intelligence.
This gets into the heart of the matter of what we'd like to talk with you today, how GIS, how this mapping software, how is that being used in creating a smart grid, and what are some good examples of that?
Well, of course, the GIS has been used in electric companies for a while, and again, for mapping their facilities. But the GIS has a lot more intelligence built into it than just simply a mapping system. So it can identify where those areas where smart grid might make more sense to put in early, or it can track the progress of a rollout of a construction of a smart grid. But more importantly, it can map out what customers are doing in terms of their consumption. So if we get an example of during a very hot day, everybody is having their air conditioners on or they're running their dryers and their water heaters all at the same time, we'll be able to map out the consumption over an area and then be able to then adjust that consumption to better match the load. And one of the things that I think is important about the whole smart grid concept and location is that one of the main things about smart grid is to try to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases. And so if we could imagine that the electric system is like a traffic jam, everybody jamming to use electricity at the same time, if we can sort of spread that out a little bit or by automatically opening and closing switches or reducing the load here and there a little bit, you could actually reduce the traffic, if you will, the electric traffic on the grid to overall reduce the amount of greenhouse gases. So that's really an advantage. And the way that the electric companies will know how to do that is by looking at location. Where are their problems? Where is their consumption? Or where is their spare capacity that they could kind of move that consumption from one place to another?
Yeah, and we've been talking about how to use location-based information to transform the electric grid in the U.S. And I'm sure people listening want to know what's in it for them. How does it benefit consumers who are listening now who pay the electric bills at the end of the month? Tell us more about that.
Well, I think knowledge is power. And one of the things that the smart grid will do is it will tell people not when they get their bill, what their bill will be, but tell them as they're consuming the electricity what the impact on their bill will be. So that it will give them an opportunity to be able to adjust their behavior. I mean, some people may not realize, well, if I'm running my air conditioner at the middle of the day, that that might be more expensive or more carbon negative than if I ran it a little bit earlier, or if I shifted load a little bit, or if I didn't run my pool filter and my electric dryer all at the same time. So what it will do is it will give people the information that they need to know about their own consumption. So from that perspective, they could reduce their electric bill. They may find also that, you know, it's interesting that my neighbor next door, who has basically the same size house, is using electricity. I wonder what it is that they're doing. And so there'll be this idea of looking at your consumption in relationship to what the utility company would expect you to be. So it's really putting it in front of you as opposed to, oh, my goodness, I get this electric bill at the end of the month, and it's too late to do anything about it then.
We've been talking about the United States so far, but how is GIS changing the electric grid across the world, especially nations like China, where more homes than ever are coming online?
Yes. Well, in all parts of the world, GIS is sort of enabling smart grid. Smart grid is being rolled out all around the world. And in more developing nations, the GIS is being used as sort of an analytical tool, a tool to help utilities understand, well, what's going to happen here? Where is the load going to grow? Where are neighborhoods going to develop? And as a result of that, it helps them in their planning process. So if you think about even in the U.S., if we put in a new off-ramp, for example, off a freeway, well, that's going to stimulate business. And so the GIS can help to identify those places that are likely to have large growths of electric consumption. Obviously, in areas that are rural or in hard-to-build areas, we'll know that that's not going to happen. So the GIS is going to help provide a roadmap for rollout of the electric system. And also, it will be able to take the overall consumption and measure it to what we're projecting maybe in the next 2 or 3 or 4 years. GIS also manages demographic information. So they'll know that maybe this is a young community, and as it grows and gets to be an older community, that the load will naturally grow as children become teenagers and consume more. So we'll be able to look at the patterns of behaviors of customers and then match that against the equipment to make sure that the electric system is built to be able to handle the new loads and to be able to understand what the relationship of the load is to the electric system. So we can switch things on and off and really reduce the amount of power failures that are going on.
That was Bill Meehan with Esri, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about the global night sky and an extraordinary astronomical event, a possible killer asteroid, asteroid Apophis, approaching Earth. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. Thank you.
So tell us about asteroid Apophis. What's happening?
Well, this asteroid is back in the news. It was actually discovered in 2004, but recently the Huffington Post ran a video on it that was a very, very scary video showing a huge collision of an asteroid with Earth, and there was an article about asteroid Apophis. In fact, this asteroid has been known, as I said, since 2004, and astronomers have been aware of its existence for that long.
All right. So astronomers are keeping their eye on this asteroid Apophis. Tell us about, apparently there's some news that it may approach Earth very close in 2012, 2013.
Right. And the asteroid, the orbit of the asteroid is semi-well known. and it's on an orbit that brings it close to Earth several times over the coming decades. So the first time will be late 2012 and early 2013. The asteroid will actually get within 22,000 miles of Earth. That's below the level of geosynchronous satellites. So that's very, very close. But it will not strike Earth in 2012, 2013. In fact, it'll be a very exciting time for astronomers because they'll be turning their telescopes on asteroid Apophis, looking at it. Amateur astronomers will all be trying to look at it. Supposedly, it'll be visible to the eye, but I suspect that when astronomers say that asteroid Apophis will be visible to the eye, that means it'll be a tiny little speck in the sky that will move very slowly in front of the stars over a period of 6 weeks to 2 months.
Yeah, wouldn't that be amazing, though, to actually be able to see this asteroid in our night sky when we're talking about late 2012 or early 2013?
It would be very incredible, but it won't be an object in 2012, 2013 that will, in a single night, just whoosh across our night sky. So, you know, don't look for that. But if you, you know, have equipment and you have some experience with the stars, you will be able to find this object. You will be able to see it over a period of weeks or months moving in front of the stars.
But the story is not over in 2012, 2013. There's this story of asteroid Apophis gets more interesting in the years ahead.
That's right. In 2029, astronomers say there is a possibility that asteroid Apophis will pass through a 600-meter keyhole, what they're calling a keyhole in space, just an area of space that the asteroid would have to pass through in order to be on a collision course with Earth. And now on our website at earthsky.org, people have been saying, why don't they know? Why don't they know whether it's going to pass through that keyhole? Why don't they know if it's on a collision course with Earth? Well, I mean, I think people sometimes don't appreciate how vast space is, and asteroid Apophis itself is only 300 meters wide. So it's a tiny, tiny object in this huge, huge ocean of space, and its orbit is just not perfectly known. But according to astronomers, if indeed in 2029 it passes through this 600-meter area of space that they're calling a keyhole, then it will indeed be on a collision course with Earth set to arrive in the year 2036.
So what happens if asteroid Apophis turns out to actually be on a collision course with Earth? What do we do then?
Well, astronomers have thought pretty hard about this possibility. I mean, since the 90s again, they've been, you know, really thinking about what would happen if we found an asteroid that was on a collision course. And they have meetings periodically every few years. They have meetings. Astronomers and engineers get together and talk about what the possibilities are. And there are many possibilities of ways to deflect an asteroid. You could send a spacecraft to the asteroid and set off a nuclear explosion either near it or on it. A very interesting way of deflecting an asteroid would be to send a spacecraft to the asteroid, land on the asteroid, and set up what's called a mass driver, which is basically kind of a pulley system where it's digging up part of the asteroid's mass and shooting it out into space, thereby decreasing the amount of mass that the asteroid has and therefore changing its orbit. So they have thought about this. They have various scenarios for how to deal with it if it happens.
But just for people listening, this apparently scientists who have spoken to Earth Sky have told us that asteroid Apophis really isn't anything to get worried about, is it?
That's right. I mean, what astronomers are saying now is that the chances of a collision are essentially zero. Astronomers aren't expecting this object to strike Earth. But, you know, it's an interesting object. It's an object that there's a, you know, infinitesimally small chance it could strike Earth. I think to the astronomers, it's really more of an opportunity to test some of the systems that they've put in place to watch for asteroids that might strike Earth. Because since the 1990s, there's been, well, actually for decades now, since I've been involved in astronomy, there's been talk of this possibility that objects from space could strike the Earth. In 1908, there was an object that hit in Siberia. Sometimes it's called the Tunguska event, that now many astronomers believe that could have been a small comet that struck the Earth, and it flattened forests for, you know, many hundreds of miles around and killed reindeer and so on. I mean, thank goodness it didn't land in a city. But so these objects are known to strike the Earth. I mean, we live in a solar system that's just full of stuff flying around. And since the 1990s, astronomers have been, you know, very vigilant about looking for these objects. The reality is that there is no large object known at this point that could even remotely be on a collision course with Earth in our lifetimes, Jorge, or even in the lifetimes of our children or grandchildren. If there were a large object out there that were on a collision course with Earth, astronomers are now saying they would have seen it. But there are many small objects like asteroid Apophis, a small 300-meter rock in space. The orbits of those objects are less well known, and, you know, they are looking for those objects. They have found this object. They're very interested in this object. They don't think it will strike Earth, but we can very much expect to hear media reports, such as the one in the Huffington Post recently, that are kind of scary. All we can say to that is, hey, don't worry. It'll be fine.
Thanks, Deborah.
Yeah, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Today on Weird Science, Ryan Britton is here with a story on mosquito nets of the sea, but maybe just a little more slimy. So Ryan, what's up with these parrotfish that you've come to talk to us about and their unique defense against parasites?
Right, so scuba divers have long enjoyed finding parrotfish and wrasse, which is another type of fish, soundly sleeping in what can best be described as mucus cocoons. So you can basically picture a fish enveloped in a shroud of its own phlegm.
Oh,
and so science really didn't know or understand why the fish did this when they slept, especially given the effort that it takes to sort of build, you know, a wrap of phlegm around them each night. Scientists estimate that it takes about 2.5% of the total energy that they expend each day to build these mucus cocoons. So they're kind of a big deal.
So I guess the scientific question is, why do fish make mucus cocoons?
Well, some researchers thought for a while that it was to protect them from eels and other hungry predators, but that wasn't it. They were still eaten by predators, even if they did build this cocoon.
And these fish would not make good sushi.
Yep, they still got eaten. You know, someone likes them. But there is a good reason why they build these things. Researchers at the University of Queensland in Australia concluded that the parrotfish are protecting themselves from a parasitic, tiny shrimp-like creature. These are like the mosquitoes of the sea. And they, like mosquitoes, they feed off the parrotfish's blood. This is kind of interesting. For the study, the researchers slipped some of the parrotfish out of the mucus cocoon. So apparently, these fish are really sound sleepers, you know, sort of like, you know, sort of pushing them out of bed, so to speak. And they did this in a tank that was full of these little parasitic shrimp. And so the fish that had no cocoon were bitten about 94% of the time, whereas those that were still, you know, in their nice little phlegm blankets were attacked just 10% of the time.
Ooh, so don't try this at home, maybe.
Right. So these parasites are so tough on the fish, and they can carry diseases that the parrotfish have basically built an entire defense mechanism, a complicated defense mechanism, just to protect themselves. So it's pretty amazing.
And I guess the big question for people listening right now is, where can we see these fish in their snot blankets?
Yep. So you can find pictures at livescience.com, msnbc.com, and nature.com.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky is Ryan Britton, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
Animal behaviors in the everyday, each and every city, state, county, country, avenue, and driveway. Rational behaviors make the system tick, makes the human do the trick, earn the pay, procreate, and quick fade. Animal behaviors.
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Beth Lebwohl joins us now to talk about research into new biofuels, looking at how cows eat grass. Beth, what's the story?
Well, it's a little more complicated than how cows eat grass. It's really about how cows digest grass. Okay, so I spoke to Dr. Eddie Rubin, who's director of the U.S. Department of Energy's Joint Genome Institute. That's a mouthful. And he explained that biofuels are fuels made from plant material. The biofuel you probably know best is ethanol. That's made from corn. But it costs a lot of money and takes a lot of time to produce because we need to break down plant material in order to make ethanol. We need to break it down into sugar. And humans actually aren't very efficient at that. We haven't studied it for a long time. We don't know how to do it well. But cows, who have been eating grass for a million years, they've cornered the market on that. So Dr. Rubin looked at the microbes inside stomachs of cows, and he explained what was so novel about what he found.
I think it's clear that we always realized that cows were very good at breaking down grasses into sugars. But there are many, many, many different microbes in the belly of cows that did this. And most of those microbes we couldn't bring to our laboratory. They won't grow in our laboratories. And so what was, I think, novel about this study is that we took advantage of these new capabilities to sequence DNA at a very, very great speed and a very small cost. And we're able to generate so much data that we're able to look at the genes for all these microbes.
Okay, so you've just heard Dr. Rubin, and he found 30,000 microbes, or rather 30,000 enzymes in the stomach of cows that could be used one day to break down grass in particular. And Dr. Rubin told me that grass is going to be the basis for next-gen biofuels, the biofuels of the future. And he also told me how grass really has an advantage over material like corn in terms of biofuel production. He explained why.
When we think about making biofuels, there are two ways of getting it. The first way is the way we're getting it now, and that's using corn or sugarcane. And the disadvantage of that is that people are using the corn or sugarcane for food crops. And so that's really a big disadvantage because you're competing food for energy. Cellulosic biofuels is used as the next generation biofuel. And the real advantage of cellulosic is it doesn't compete with food crops. It grows on different land. It frequently will grow on marginal lands. But the disadvantage of cellulosic biofuels is that we're not good at converting plant material into sugar that's needed eventually in the creation of the biofuel. And so this research is sort of helping us improve the efficiency of the breakdown of plant material so to increase the feasibility of next-generation biofuels.
So, Beth, what's the takeaway message here on research into how cows digest grass for biofuels?
Well, Dr. Rubin found the genetic information for 30,000 novel microbes, or rather enzymes. They're the machinery that breaks down grass. And so those can one day be used, hopefully, in biofuel production.
New fuels with a little help from cows. Thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
EarthSky's Beth Lebwohl, and we're EarthSky, a clear voice for science. That's our show. Thanks for joining us on EarthSky. This week's show was recorded at the EarthSky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, My Education and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.